United States v. Lacy, 17-3119. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is William D. Lund, and I represent the appellant, Dedrick Lacy. I'm going to switch the order a bit and concentrate first on count two, which is the charge of sex trafficking by force or fraud, and then count three, which is the interstate transportation, and then come back to count one on the whether the court should have given instructions on the term sex act. Count two involves the use of law enforcement witnesses to make a case that it simply couldn't make with its own witness. You'll recall in the record that the prosecution in its opening statement tried to make the argument that the defendant at that time was a sexual predator, that he had forced the victim to have sex. But when the victim took the stand and she was...
This is S.G. that we're talking about.
S.G., yes. When the victim took the stand, she was asked about the incident in the car outside of a motel room. And she said, "I didn't want to do anything, and I wasn't going to." The prosecutor twice tried to get her to talk about the fact that he had forced her to have sex. And she never said that that occurred. And in fact, later, the defense attorney asked her whether she'd been forced to do anything that she didn't want to do that night, and she said no. What would then happen is, without any objection from the defense attorney, the government then puts on two witnesses, and they are law enforcement witnesses, and they testify to out-of-court statements made by the victim, which are totally contrary to what the victim herself testified at the trial. They testified that the victim was forced to have oral sodomy, and that if she didn't do that, that she would otherwise not get out alive. This type of situation has been dealt with once before by this court in Brooks in 1962, and it involved the sex trafficking case. And the court held that this type of use of out-of-court statements as substantive evidence constituted plain error, and substantially swayed the judgment, and it was not even a matter of whether there was some other evidence in the case, such as if you were dealing on an insufficiency of the evidence charge or argument, but rather, even though there might have been some other evidence, the court decided that this evidence was so important that it swayed the judgment in the case. And our argument is that that's what happened in this count.
Yeah. We're under plain error review on this.
Yes, it was not raised by the defense attorney. So in terms of plain error, you have basically the argument that there was error and it was plain. Here you're introducing, Brooks very clearly explains why this was plain error. The witness was never asked to give an opportunity to admit, deny, or explain. Then you have the police officers take the stand and introduce this substantive evidence. There's no basis, although the government argues that this could be introduced as a prior consistent statement under 801D1B. It's not a consistent statement at all. This court actually dealt with this type of issue in Tome in 1995. 801D1B is actually a very narrow statute that deals with charges of recent fabrication or improper influence, and it's not used to bolster the credibility of a witness who, such as the victim, where her credibility may have been attacked.
So we come down to basically on the harmless error, whether there was prejudice or whether it was harmless. Was there any evidence on this count against this involving SG for any other acts other than that oral sex act in the car?
Well, the count is that he's trafficking her as a prostitute.
So if there was other evidence that he was trafficking her as a sex prostitute for profit, then why wouldn't we conclude that this single event of oral sex in the car that was basically rape, even if there was error to get evidence on that and threw that out, there was still plenty of evidence of her being used as a prostitute generally. So why wouldn't it be
error? She has to be used as a prostitute through force or fraud. That's the answer.
But she testified about force, about feeling unable to resist him taking her driver's license or the license to the car or the keys. So, quite apart from these two officers' testimony, wasn't there enough other evidence generally of her being, by force, required to be a sex prostitute?
No.
Why?
And that is, certainly with regard to force, taking her car, you consider the evidence, you consider the record as a whole under Davis v. Workman. The record as a whole indicates that she always was in possession of her car. She drives the car the next day. She's always in possession of her car. There was testimony she took her phone. She's always in possession of her phone. She's checking her phone.
Are you saying that there wasn't evidence that he took her keys and her phone?
She says that he took her keys and phone, but the whole record indicates that she had her phone that night. She had her phone. She had her car whenever she wanted to use it.
The evidence most favorable to the government, and certainly on this case, I haven't studied the record in detail, but just the way the briefs presented it, it gives me the feeling that the jury could have concluded that the defendant used the force of his personality and threats to intimidate her into acting the way she did.
But the Kodiakos decision, which was followed by Brooks, says that you don't just look at a few minor areas. You have to look at what was done here, which was establishing him as a sexual predator, which they don't do otherwise. I mean, she's taking him to the car dealership the next day and introducing him to the car salesman as her boyfriend. That is not sexual predation. So we think that...
If we read this whole record, you don't think that a jury could conclude that he was using force or threats against her to get her to comply to this?
No. Overall, I don't.
So if we just put aside the oral sex in the car on the grounds that relied on improper hearsay evidence, you then come to a sufficiency of the evidence argument and you say, court, when you put that car incident aside, there is not any evidence of coerced sex requirements that would support a verdict as to her.
Again, I disagree with the characterization. Under Kodiakos and Brooks, it's not the issue. In fact, it's expressly stated in Brooks that it's not enough as to whether there's evidence to support the verdict. It's whether this evidence that was presented substantially swayed the judgment. And that's what happened here.
Well, you're not making a sufficiency of the evidence argument. You are making a straight hearsay argument. So why can't we say, why couldn't it be? I'm not saying this is what we would do at all. I'm not even beginning to intimate this is what we would do, but I'm just asking as one of the options. Why isn't the option there of saying there was a hearsay violation? That evidence goes out. Now we have to consider whether that is harmless. Now, one of your responses might be that the government isn't asserting harmless error here. I'm not sure that they are they?
Yeah, they're saying that it was appropriate under 801 D1B.
Right, they're saying it wasn't hearsay.
Yeah.
So then it seems to me your best defense might be, look, court, you shouldn't be addressing a harmless error way to save this if the government doesn't argue it. Does the government argue harmless error?
They haven't, no.
But you're arguing plain error, so you've got to show all the elements of
that's
plain
right.
error.
Yes, and this is a situation where you shift
so you have
the
to
focus.
Show, you have to show that you were prejudiced. That's a good bring us back to the important issue here. How do you get around that?
Well, because you shift the focus to the out-of-court statements that he is a sexual predator who has made this woman do what she did when, in fact, She's negotiating with him about how to become a prostitute and how much money she's going to make. She comes up with her name, Paradise. She makes the statement that she knew she was going to give herself up. She knew all of this. This was not force or fraud. This was an amicable relationship that they had. And they needed to establish that he was a sexual predator by getting in those officers' statements. And that's what swayed the judgment on that count. I'd like to switch over to count three.
Just for the sake of efficiency, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
On count three. There's the intent element in count three.
Yes.
And why didn't the texts that went back and forth between Mr. Lacey and Mr. Reed prove the intent element? Why weren't those incriminating on intent?
Because they're all in Kansas.
You've got the crossing state lines element. You're backing up, aren't you?
No. All of the texts are being made in the state of Kansas. So he's saying,
well,
I may need
matter.
To get a...
Why would that even matter if in fact, the crossing state lines element is proved? And the question is, what was the intent in taking her across state lines? If the texts occurred before they got over there, they still would be probative of intent, wouldn't they?
Well, there's no evidence that he was ever in the state of Texas.
Well, then let's back up.
That's a problem.
Why wouldn't it be reasonable, given that the car is found there, that he borrows the car from Mr. Reed, for the jury to conclude that he drove it to Texas?
Because he's never found there. There's no indication that he was ever there. Nobody ever sees him drive the car. He doesn't check into the hotel. The hotel proprietor doesn't put him there. There's none of his clothes that are in the hotel room. Nobody sees him there. It's more likely that he simply gave her the car and the phone to go drive to Texas, and he was later then going to catch a bus maybe and catch up with her. That's the most likely thing that happened here.
Well, we've got to decide what the jury could do. He was with her closely.
He was with somebody.
The day before. No, but the day before, while they were still in Kansas, he was with her. He was with her in a hotel room. His friend loaned him the car, not her, the car. Why would it just not be permissible for the jury to conclude that he drove it down there?
Because there's just nobody who puts him there with the car. I mean, they have to establish that one way or another. I realize the car is there, but nobody sees him with the car.
And the jury might conclude that the friend would only loan him the car, not her. And the jury might conclude that he still found her as a lucrative asset and that he needed to be near her to control that asset. I mean, all those things are permissible inferences that a jury could conclude, I would think.
Well, you have to have something to suggest that he actually is setting up a prostitution operation in Texas.
Well, that's that's the intent part. Not that we've got the crossing state lines part and we've got the intent part.
Yes.
All right. So why didn't the text between Lacey and Reed, the content of those texts, support the intent element?
Because under Broxmire, he's only doing something in the state of Kansas at that point. And you don't get him crossing state lines and setting up a prostitution operation in the state of
Texas. The content of the text. Why don't the content of the text show an intent to take this victim across state lines for these improper purposes?
Because he never says he's going to do that. He says he's going to get a bus ticket for himself, a single ticket, to go back to Texas. He doesn't ever talk about taking her back to Texas.
That's where she ended up.
Well, that may be, and maybe he decided that the best way to get them, the police, off of his tail was to give her the cell phone and her the car and have her drive to Texas.
Well, if his purpose was to get the police off his tail, that alone ought to establish intent, doesn't it?
To have her go to Texas? It may establish possibly an intent to send her to Texas, but again, it doesn't establish any intent for her to become involved in a prostitution operation in Texas. And you've got the Mortensen case and the Hansen versus Half case, which says you may do something in one state, but that doesn't mean you can't travel and you're necessarily going to travel and do the same thing in another state. And that's never addressed. As to sex acts, it's a legally significant term.
Are we back to count one now?
Count one, yes. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay. You've got 10 seconds, but we'll give it to you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Jason Hart. I'm an assistant United States attorney for the District of Kansas. I am going to, I'll get to, I guess, the count two arguments in just a moment, but very quickly, if I may, address the arguments made relative to count three. The question the Court asks is, why didn't the text prove intent? The government's position is they do, and that they are painfully clear as to what the defendant's intent was. When the defendant's appellate counsel says that all the texts are in Kansas, that's actually not in evidence. There's not really any evidence in the record as to where the defendant is when the texts are sent. It's simply that the texts are sent. And those texts themselves do not prove that there's no intent. And, in fact, we actually do have evidence that somebody does see him drive the car, and this court even identified who that person was. It's Mr. Reed, who loaned him the car, who gave him the car. What I note about this whole argument is defendant's counsel at the trial court level essentially conceded that Texas was where the defendant was going. He made that concession in his closing argument.
Well, can we just come back to the text? You say the text show intent, but could you be a little more specific?
Well, I think we, in the briefing, I go through quite a bit of those texts.
Well, you don't have to go through all of them, but why don't you make a couple of your strongest points? Because it sounds like we have a debate about what was in those texts.
In the text, and I'll go back, I think it's in my factual statement. In the text, there's a series of text messages that are sent to Dana Reed, and these are right after he is confronted by Rodney Hickman, the custodian of BJ, the victim in count one. These show that Reed is bringing the car, which Reed then confirmed in his testimony, and approximately 3 hours later, the defendant messages that he's on the road, followed by, "I just need a week max to stack and lay low." And later he says, "We check in the hotel." Now, what's important about those is that there's the use of the "we," which is the plural, which indicates there's somebody else with him. Also, the fact that he is indicating he needs a week to stack and make low is a reference to making money. Now, he doesn't have any other job known to anybody in this constellation of activity other than engaging in pimping. And so when he says, "I need a week max to stack to make money and to lay low," to avoid being caught by the police, and he's checking into a hotel, the only other person he's known to be involved with is SB, the victim in count three. Now, later on, SB is found at the hotel along with the defendant, along with Mr. Reed's car, which I think a jury could reasonably conclude just from that information alone that there was an intent to take SB to Texas to engage in prostitution offenses. So those would be, I think, some of the, I guess, highlights of those text messages. But I think it reasonable to say that the jury had sufficient evidence in front of it to reasonably conclude that the defendant did, in fact, engage in or had the intent to take SB to Texas for the purposes of engaging in a prostitution enterprise. And I would note, as we pointed out in a brief, there is no scienter as to age or scienter as to age. In six other circuits, this circuit has not yet addressed that, but I don't think there's any reason why this court would go upstream against all these other circuits. Turning then back to the arguments relative to count two, these are the arguments related to the 19-year-old SG. What is notable about the trial is that the defendant actually kind of got into what SG told the police by virtue of his questioning of SG. Now, this was a thing where the government asked a question about what happened in the car, and she leads everything up to the point of he asks her for sex, demands sex, and this is after she's described performing a commercial sex act with a John. So if this court were to say, hey, setting aside the oral sex in the car issue, yes, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find that the victim had already described a commercial sex act that was undertaken by force or fraud or coercion. So in terms of a harmless error review, I would contend that this would be harmless. We're not there yet because this is presented as plain error since there was no objection made. But at the time the defense is asking her questions, he says, but later that same day, you talk to the police and tell them about what's going on with Mr. Lacey, right? She says, yes. And he says, and you don't tell any about him trying to drive you off the road, do you? Now, what that does at that point is it opens up the door to what SG told the police when she finally does talk to them. Because what that question is designed to get at is, well, why aren't you telling them these things? And the reason why she's not telling the officers about being driven off the road is because there was something else much more important to her, and that was the sexual assault that had happened. Now, in her testimony, when trial counsel, and it was me, when I asked her the question, did anything happen in the car, she says, I don't know, I don't recall, I don't remember, but we move on from that. Because it's not important. Because she's already established there was no consent, the predatory relationship, that she had been tricked into this, that she had been told that it was going to be one thing when it turned out it was another. She'd already described that she didn't want to do the sex act with the John in the client's hotel. And so this is simply stuff that occurs after the fact.
Okay, so if this sounds like your rebuttal as to step three, the plain air review.
Correct. If I understand the court's, this is relating to.
We're gonna assume for the sake of discussion.
Sure.
That the officers, that the government couldn't rely on the officers' testimony, it's hearsay. But you're arguing that the defendant appellant cannot establish step three because there was evidence in the record of coercion preceding that incident. Is that your argument?
Correct. And there's actually evidence of fraud that he essentially tricked her into thinking that it was going to be a modeling gig where they were going to be doing promos and she would be making tons of money and traveling the country, and also the coercion or force. The coercion being the taking of her property, which, as we outlined at trial, she was homeless at the time. So when he takes control of her car, that is taking control of her home. It's not simply a small piece of property. It's all she has.
But didn't counsel say that the record shows otherwise about the taking of control?
No, the record actually shows that she described him taking her keys and exerting control over the car. The only point where she gets control over the car again is when they drive to the supercar guys the next day. By that point in time, the commercial sex act has already happened. It happened that evening. And so he is exerting control over that car. My memory of the record is that she describes him driving her as well as BJ, the victim in count one, to a hotel. And exerting control over not only her car and her car keys, but also her phone. There's indication from the testimony of the supercar guy that the defendant is the one that is controlling her phone as well the next day, because when he calls her, a male answers the phone, and then 14 minutes later, the defendant as well as SG show up, and they try to sell the car. And when I say they try to sell the car, I mean the defendant tries to sell the car, and the SG does not want that to happen. Now, her getting control of the car after that makes reasonable sense, because if the intent was that they were going to sell the car at that point in time, one could reasonably conclude that they drove two separate cars as opposed to just one car. But it's not clear in the record whether they came together or separate. But they leave separately, and even that is not particularly clear, because at that point in time, SG reports being upset. That was reported by the Matthew Molina, the supercar guy. And then she describes getting in this sort of, I think as she described it, Super Mario carts going down Kellogg, which is a main three or four lanes on one side, three or four lanes on another side, a highway that goes through Wichita. So in terms of other evidence of fraud and coercion, absolutely it's present, and it preceded anything related to what law enforcement talked about. So in terms of whether this would be harmless error, the government's position is absolutely it would be harmless, because there's a significant amount of evidence that preceded any of the conduct related to what the officers talked about. And quite frankly, what the officers talked about, it's just one small little piece that there is a commercial, or not a commercial sex act, but a sex act that occurs in the car of oral sex.
You didn't specifically argue harmless error, so as Judge Matheson points out, really we're looking at whether the defendant has proven prejudice under the plain error analysis.
Correct. And that's how I presented my briefing, but in answer to the court's question, I wanted to fully address that. The government's position is that there is no prejudice, in part because if anything, what the introduction of this particular piece of evidence did was it illustrated that SG, in her earlier statement to in the court, was different than what she told police later. Now, the jury was free to say, well, we found that that was inconsistent and not believe her, or they could say, you know, maybe she didn't want to talk about that, and we still find her believable. In any case, that particular piece of evidence or testimony about that there was oral sex occurring in the car was not offered as substantive evidence of any charge. And it wasn't argued as substantive evidence of any charge. If anything, it would have given the jury some reason to think about the credibility of SG. And since it was out there and the jury determined that, well, she was credible, the fact that there is this inconsistency didn't prejudice the defendant. It's simply that they decided, contrary to what the defendant wanted, is that SG was believable and that she had been the victim of fraud and coercion in order to get her to perform a commercial sex act with a John in a hotel. I know I've got about 3 minutes left. Unless you have additional questions relative to count two, I'll turn to count one very briefly. Count one relates to a challenge of sufficiency for evidence relative to the sex acts committed by BJ, the 16-year-old minor who was then 17 when she testified, and alternatively that the district court should have given an instruction that defined sex acts. As relates to that second issue, I briefed that separately as my issue two. I'm not going to talk about that one because I think that's sufficiently briefed where there is no error as it relates to the instruction, because the instruction, that is the pattern instruction, was given. And it's unlikely that the jury was actually misled considering the facts presented as well as the instruction given. As related to the challenge for the sufficiency of the evidence relative to the sex acts, at the time that BJ was testifying, BJ was 17 years old. When she was testifying, she was, I think as the record will demonstrate, had some difficulties in talking about what had happened to her. And that's natural, and we would assume that some folks will have challenges when talking about their own sexual abuse at the hands of another person. In this particular case, when she's asked, and it's not a leading question, it's a direct question, there was no suggestion of the answer, she could answer yes or no, was asked if she was made to perform sex acts, she said yes. Now, at that time, the jury could have said, well, we think a 16-year-old probably knows what a sex act is and what a sex act isn't, and it could be done at that point in time, but it wasn't. Because then the government presented additional evidence in the context of Facebook messages, which discussed Facebook messages between BJ and the defendant, where he talked about the fact that she was on her period, and that even if that's the case, that she could use her mouth, which is not for kissing, but in this context would have been for oral sex. There's also text messages about the defendant providing her condoms, which as a female, she has no use for condoms unless they're being used on the male genitals of the people that she's being made to perform sex acts with. So with this information in mind, the jury had ample evidence in order to find that the defendant had, in fact, made the minor engage in sex acts of a commercial nature. And at any, there's an extreme unlikelihood that the jury could have been unreasonably conclude that the minor did not actually perform a commercial sex act or sex act, and instead engaged in something, as I think the defendant in his brief described, as exposure of the breasts or something else. Based on the evidence presented in the record, for all three of the counts, the government would ask that you find and affirm, find the evidence sufficient and affirm the jury's verdict as to all three. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
The line from the text to Dana Reed is, on the road headed to Salina. They're going to Salina. Within 2 hours, they're checking into a motel. Everything is done in the state of Kansas. She gets mad at him because he wouldn't buy a Cadillac for her when they go to the super guy's store, and that's what creates the last problem. And then finally, with regard to purchases of condoms and getting hamburgers at McDonald's, it's all the personal relationship between them. In fact, she makes the statement, I'm not doing it, period, unless it's with you.
Doesn't that put him in Texas, though?
Oh, we're talking about the sex acts, actually, in count one. I'm sorry. She's not having sex with anyone else, with other Johns. Whatever she's doing in those motels, it's not sexual intercourse. It doesn't qualify for a sexual act under the federal statute.
But you were talking about count one, not count three.
Well, I initially was talking about count two. Or, I'm sorry, about count three, and then I switched over.
I'm sorry, to count one.
I apologize.
But under count one, there was evidence that she did perform for a John sex act, right?
No. Well, she went to a motel. We know that, and she did what she used the conclusory term. I did a sex act.
Yeah.
But the problem is, federal statute requires that a sex act contemplates a touching by another person of either the genitalia or the anus. There's no evidence that she ever testified she did anything like that.
It just depends on whether there's evidence enough for the jury to conclude that it was a conduct that was clearly within a sex act. I mean, if this case involved some conduct that would arguably be outside the sex act, be normally understood. I just didn't see any reference to that in the evidence at all.
The government knew how to prove this. They knew how to prove it in count two with regard to SG. They could have asked this woman the same questions. They know about the Tome case, which involves a six-year-old, where they know that it's important to establish the case. They didn't do it in this case to establish that a sex act under the federal statute was violated, committed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Appreciate the arguments from both counsel.